I would not tell lies to you, like the promises they did not keep, and how they fenced us in like sheep, said to us, come take our hand, set us up on mission land, told us to read, to write and pray. Then they took the children away, took the children away, the children away. Snatched from their mother's breast, said this is for the best, took them away. Welcome and the Holy Spirit said you've got to understand, we'll give to them what you can't give, teach them how to really live, teach them how to live their self, humiliated them instead, taught them that and taught them this, and others taught them prejudice. You took the children away, the children away, breaking their mother's heart, caring us all about, took them away. One dark day on Framlingham, came and didn't give a damn. My mother cried, go get their dad. He came running, frightened me. Mother's tears were pulling down. Dad shaped up and stood his ground. He said, you touch my kids and defied me. Then they took the stronger family, took us away. They took us away. Snatched from our mother's breast, said this is for the best, took us away. Set us up again and gave us gifts to ease the pain, sent us off to foster homes. As we grew up, we felt alone, cause we were acting white yet feeling black. One sweet day, all the children came back, the children came back, the children came back where their hearts grow strong, back where they all belong. The children came back, said the children came back, the children came back where they understand, back to their mother's land. The children came back, back to their mother, back to their father, back to their sister, back to their brother, back to their people, back to their land. All the children came back. The children came back. Yes, I came.
Yeah, hello, here in the studio today, Felicia Herrschaft, and a guest with me is Simone Slee from Australia.
Hi, Felicia.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, wonderful. So, we heard in a piece here, a track from Australia, from that CD, Buried Countries. So, what kind of remembrance do you have on this song, on the children?
Well, this is a song by Archie Roach, and he's an Aboriginal, Indigenous musician. And we thought we'd start that today just as some sort of in memory of the children that were taken from their families, their Indigenous families in Australia. It's a very sad story, really, from, I guess, the turn of the century, not the most recent century, but from the 1900s. Until as late as the 1950s, there was a government policy that Indigenous people should be integrated into the Anglo-white settlers' community, so that there would be an integration, some kind of racial integration. And the very sad thing was that children that were of had some white blood in them from the Aboriginal community were taken away from their mothers forcefully and given to white Australian families to rear them, unbeknownst to Australian white families assumed that there were children that weren't wanted. So it really has come out in the last 20 or so years, particularly in the last 15 years, there's become an awareness of what this policy was. And now there's some attempt to make amends for that situation.
Mm-hmm. And you were born in Horsham in Victoria?
Horsham.
Horsham.
The English pronunciation, Horsham. That's right.
And where can you probably locate this Horsham in Australia, because we have to do Australia is a continent which is very far away from Europe. Mm-hmm. And the question is really, what kind of continental thinking is developed in Australia during mm-hmm. a long time of period of politics?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll just start with where Horsham is geographically. Horsham is in the south of Australia, in Victoria, which is the southernmost state of the mainland country. And it's a rural community. It's 4 hours from Melbourne by car. We only drive 100 kilometres an hour on the road, so it's probably faster if you're in Germany, because you could drive faster. But it's 4 hours drive, and it's very flat and it's hot in the summers and dry. And just to the north of where I grew up, there was the Little Desert National Park, which is quite it's very interesting from a landscape point of view. It's very flat, and the trees only grow as high as your knees. So it's very flat and dry, and it's traditionally the wheat belt, where a lot of wheat was grown, and also a bit further south, sheep, which is it used to be in the 1950s the economic basis for finances in Australia, wheat and sheep.
Yeah.
The wheat and sheep industry, but obviously with minerals and mining and natural resources.
Yeah. And your family, when did they come to Australia?
My family, I'm actually around 7 generations Australian, which is quite a long time. My family came out for the gold rush, so in the 1840s. So it was after the first shipment of convicts to Australia. So we weren't in the first ships. We were basically, my family were from Scotland and Ireland and England, and were really economic refugees, I guess, economic migrants, looking for a better life, like lots of other Australians, and trying their luck on the gold field without any success. And then they went farming.
Yeah. And now you are here for some reasons, because you studied art and you made your master's in fine arts at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology in Melbourne, mm-hmm. and a Bachelor of Fine Arts. So you studied art, and now you're here for now this week starting 3 exhibitions, and tonight you will have a performance at the Galerie Wildwechsel.
That's right. We've been here in Frankfurt for since last October 2004, and I've got 3 shows in this next 2 weeks. It's a little bit. It's a lot of fun. So tonight there's a performance at Wildwechsel, but it's really it's more an action than a performance. It's a sculpture with an action attached to it. So it's not a performance in a traditional theatrical sense. It's more sculpturally based.
Yeah, it's called Help a Sculpture.
It's called Help a Sculpture, that's right.
Yeah.
And I get the reason for that is many of the last works that I've been doing since being here, I've been looking at perhaps not so much when you think about a sculptural object, you often think of something very stable. But what I'm more interested in is the instability of these ideas. And this work, Help a Sculpture, comes out of a series of other works I did which were in Museum Gersh last July, August, which were called the prop series, where I had props holding up sculptures. So this is a continuation of that work. And in this case, I am helping a sculpture, but really who's helping a sculpture are some goldfish helping my sculpture stand up.
Stand up.
Well, if I didn't have the goldfish, and you will see when I don't have the goldfish combined with my sculpture, it doesn't stand up. And the sculpture needs to stand up sometimes.
Okay. Yeah, and how did you organize now the goldfishes?
Well, I've been very fortunate.
In which condition are they?
They're in a fit condition, I hope. And we've been taking very good care of them. And fortunately, the gallery I'm with, and his name is Jürgen Wolfstädter, and his partner, Katja, have also been taking great care of my fish. So I'm very fortunate I've been able to borrow things because we're not living here permanently. I was able to borrow the aquarium from a friend, and also I was able to borrow from a very kind Tierladen the fish for 3 weeks. And I trust that they'll be as happy when they return to the Tierladen as when I received them.
Yeah. So, okay, so tonight, this is Galerie Wildwechsel. Mm-hmm. It's Rotlinstraße, I think 88, 88.
No, I think it's 98.
98? Are you sure?
That's what it said here.
Ja, it's 98. Und die Eröffnung also ist um 19 Uhr.
Genau.
Okay.
Stimmt.
Ja, wunderbar.
Tschüss. And just using a German word there.
Yeah, and the other exhibition is tomorrow. The opening is tomorrow. This is at the Frankfurt Atelier Frankfurt.
Atelier Frankfurt.
Yeah, and this is together with Guy Benfield and with David Harley.
That's
and
right.
You all, and they both are from Australia too. Mm-hmm. And maybe I say something before we play music and an interview with Guy, something about his works. Because Guy Benfield's works involve, and to a degree, feature, elaborate sets and decor. Benfield shows what might be thought of as ironized demonstrations of artistic endeavor. They enact purposely. What do you mean by purposely? What are they doing, these objects?
What does perversely mean?
Perversely.
Perverse means... How do I explain? Perverse is a little bit ironic. It has a black side to it. So he's using them. He uses things not in an earnest way, I suppose. He actually kind of critiques the objects he's using, and often he uses objects that are about lifestyle
yeah.
and design. And he actually presents them back to us in a way as props and sets for actually setting up. I see Guy's work as looking at the way identity is constructed.
Yeah.
And the way, the kinds of props that we use to create the way we look or the lifestyle we lead and where we shop and that kind of thing. Mm. So that's how he, in a way, critiques. I see when he uses things, he uses them from a point to critique that. That's how I would understand that.
Yeah. Yeah, part of the work's operation is to shrink, miniaturize, condense the tradition as it reanimates it, a work of summation and summary. A wrong end of the telescope effect is brought about partly through this use of sets and video. Mm-hmm. These are performances captured already in the past, facts beyond our reach, which we can witness but no longer affect. Of course, the case is as much the opposite. The video is the art, includes within it these distancing effects for our judgments, these being part of the video's meaning, not part of its ontological status. Yeah, Guy Benfield's works are uncannily able to have it both ways and to enjoy the tension and instability of the relation. Yeah, he will show kind of performance tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. That's right. He does at a, I guess,
he's a telescope star.
I know he's doing a performance tomorrow with a turntable.
Yeah.
And he's I think it's going to be very interesting. He's going to be there as a dressed in a suit, and he's lying down using a turntable to make drawings. So he's actually I think it's going to be very interesting. He's been spending the last 12 months living in Lisbon, and he's been, I think, very much looking at the relationship between performance and video and how you make and generate art, the kind of systems that you use, artists use to make art.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we listen to the interview with Guy Benfield.
Great.
I've always wanted to be an artist since I was... I remember when I was 12 years old. I wanted to do advertising, you know, advertising like my dad, my father. And then I wanted to be a cartoonist, cartoons, make like Disney cartoons.
Yeah.
And then when I got a little bit older, I became... my parents were artists, but not you know, show. They didn't show work. They did it for So I mean, they went to art school, and my mother painted sort of Australian abstract expressionist paintings, and flowers and sort of traditional stuff.
Yeah,
and I decided to go to art school because I hated going to normal school.
Okay.
So I went to art school very young, like 16.
Okay.
Yeah. And my father used to take me to draw the life drawing.
Yeah.
In a church where you draw naked people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it started from there.
Yeah.
And so I went to art school. When art school, not many people were going to art school at that time. So it was quite easy to get in.
In Australia.
Yeah.
It's easy.
Well, it was. Now it's very hard.
Yeah.
Because I have very good art schools there now. Yeah. Very competitive.
Yeah. And how would you say, because you mentioned that you tried to consider about or had a look on Aboriginal art. Is there a kind of tension between the culture of the Aboriginals and the Australian culture?
Tension.
Yeah, tension.
Sure.
How would you describe it?
Well, I suppose there's a lot of guilt. People feel quite guilty for what happens, so that all want to forget about it, or guilty about the treatment of Aboriginals.
Yeah.
Tension, as in that, or tension as in Aboriginal work, artwork, and.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure. I don't know how to answer that.
But what is your... are you influenced as an artist by...
Aboriginal work?
Or by, how would you say, Australian culture is something where you are influenced on?
I suppose I'm,
lifestyle.
I suppose I'm more... I suppose reacting. Being brought up in the 70s...
Or something.
And modernism is probably the big influence.
Yeah.
Because you live with... in Australia, I was brought up living inside modernism.
Yeah.
The houses in the suburbs, the way, the lifestyle,
yeah.
Everything
yeah.
was related to modernism, really.
Okay.
And I suppose I've always been sort of wrestling with that, you
yeah.
know, for my life. But also in Australia, you look, always looking, I found myself always looking to Europe or America.
Yeah.
And you're always looking and wondering, and the reality of the art world and artists was completely unreal, because you didn't know how to experience that because you're living so far away.
Yeah.
And so it was a lot of isolation, and it made you dream too much about your ideas about the career of being an artist or being an artist were quite distorted. Because in reality, it's not like it is when you're reading art magazines and always obsessing about what is new and what is avant-garde all the time.
Mm.
But by the time you get the information back to Australia, it's already what was avant-garde news finished. It's always, there's something else.
Yeah.
But that's a really bad way to exist, chasing the new.
Mm.
But since I've been in Europe and America, I realise that doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
It's just, it exists in the form of journals like art magazines and top 10 lists and top 100 artists and all that sort of rubbish.
Mm.
But that's all, you know. It doesn't exist here, in my reality here.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much, you know.
Okay.
So, but I suppose I react to my upbringing through modernism, the way I was taught at art school, I react against. The painting was it, and there was no other form that I should be researching.
Yeah.
Genre. That was the 80s.
Yeah.
And how things have to be well made all the time.
Yeah.
Or so specific, you know, you're right, you can't make anything fluid or... So I'm more and more trying to sort of break down or react against that sort of thing.
Mm. And what is that on this picture? A horse?
That's a drawing.
Yeah.
So, as you know.
Like oriental.
Zoom in. Yeah, it's kind of like a weird mixture of...
Folk?
When I was a child, a teenager, I used to look a lot at fantasy drawings.
Yeah.
From Roger Dean, who was an American fantasy science fiction. And so I kind of combined these elements of this his drawing style to my drawing style.
Okay.
And I produced these kind of hybrid drawings.
Okay.
They're like a mixture of fantasy and...
Yeah. And will you show these pictures? These, well?
I will show new ones.
Ah, yeah. Which are hybrid drawings.
Yeah, but they're quite different to these. See these frames? All these drawings have been sold because they've got very pretty frames and people love them.
Yeah.
But,
because of the frames.
Yeah, I had another show without frames.
Yeah.
No one was interested.
I know.
It was terrible.
It's hard.
Because I thought... Yeah, I'm going to, you know, I sold every single drawing.
And you don't frames on yourself?
No, I have to professional.
Okay, but it was your idea.
Yeah, to make them cornered.
Yeah.
It was really for this exhibition before that I showed you the, in the style of Tobias.
Okay. And what, do you have pictures of the drawings you will show?
No, I don't.
Okay.
They're only at the gallery.
Yeah, in the gallery.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
So, I sort of create these hybrid, dreamy kind of first I do a drawing of myself and then I kind of change it.
Yeah.
They worked out well, those drawings.
Yeah, well.
And these kind of weird mixture of man-woman.
Yeah.
This one's a bit of a man-woman kind of...
And a lean-to. No.
When it opens.
No kangaroo. Come on.
No kangaroo. It's a deer. I know, I should draw more kangaroos. You're right.
This is what's on your job.
No, but it's true. I should do more. Make it more Australian.
More Australia.
Yeah, I'm not doing enough.
Things which can be...
Well, when I go back to Australia, I'm doing a I'm going to do a studio residency in Australia, and I will be going to the desert.
Okay.
And into Aboriginal tribal land to work to make a video.
The dream path is... How do you dream in Australia? About what?
What do I dream?
Yeah.
Oh, just crazy dreams about... You know, like everyone else. I dream in English.
okay.
Do you dream in English?
Sometimes.
Yeah? Because a friend English of mine, yeah, he's been in Germany for 20 years. He's finally just dreaming in German now. It's interesting.
But I think sometimes it's no language. It's
no,
more,
it's not. Well, do you,
but the dream passes from the Aboriginals that they can communicate over dream passes. Do you know that story?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
How to get into it as an artist?
Well, I don't know. I've got a friend who's a documentary filmmaker, and he's made a lot of documentaries on Aboriginal culture.
The spirit country.
And I'm going to go with him.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe produce some performances or things like negotiating with the building, but with the landscape.
Yeah.
Not necessarily with the people. But to have the back user see what happens, you know.
Yeah.
I think it'd be interesting to shift that and to bring that here.
Yeah.
To say show in Frankfurt.
Yeah.
Because of you will look at it. It's purely, you know, the Australian landscape and me working with it. It's going to be interesting how I can confuse all this other information.
Yeah, Simon, how did Guy Benfield get this CD, Reise durch die Krautrock-Szene?
Well, he was very excited. He said, I've got this great CD. And he's been living in New York, and apparently you can pick up lots of there's lots of good music shops. Yeah. So he found that in New York, in the music shop. And he has a great interest in all sorts of kinds of music. So I think, yeah. And I think also he likes certain periods of music. So he's very enthusiastic. And I think also because now he's in Frankfurt, yeah, in Germany, for 1 week, he can play his, let me get it right, Krautrock in its home country. So he's excited.
Yeah, and David Harley is another artist who is part of the exhibition tomorrow in the exhibition Europe Effect. What do you mean by Europa Effect?
I guess really we chose that name because David has had an atelier at Frankfurt. At Atelier Frankfurt.
An atelier.
Yes. That's my German. And as a part of that residency, you can have a show in, yeah, the gallery. And he invited both Guy and I to do this show. And we were interested in what happens when you've been in another place for a while. And I think we worked out together. We'd been here for 1,250 days collectively.
Mm.
And I guess we were interested in this idea of it's just a simple title really, but this idea of effect being also about some kind of passion or being knocked out in some kind of way or made delirious.
Yeah.
So it's probably just a silly English idea about German words, but we liked it that it had a K in it.
Yeah.
Europa.
Yeah, in a way you share an interest in the tenuous membrane of the personal and intimate in a public context, and intrigue with the facade of design and the borders between display and person.
That's from the press release. But, sorry. Maybe that's my performance piece.
Now we are failing.
Sorry, now we are failing.
Now we are failing through this radio show. Now I know what you mean by failing. That was really a failure now. But
sorry.
Maybe it's a good transition to what digital art is. Because digital art is an interdisciplinary work and is a hybrid process in which artists engage with practices and outcomes that go beyond any single art form. And David isn't a digital artist, isn't he?
David is a digital artist, but also he has a background as a painter, and I think that's why it makes it so interesting when he's been working on the computer for the last 7 years, so maybe as long as I've known him. And he works with it very fluidly in a way that you might draw or sketch. So in a way it's interesting when the two come together. And David has some interesting ideas, which I really appreciate, about time and space when you actually paint in the computer, which is quite different to when you paint tangibly with real paint. Things that happen in certain times can be relocated, and you can shift layers. When you work on a painting, for example, you've always got one layer directly on the top, on the top, on the top, on the top. But when you work in the computer, you can begin to kind of relocate those layers in other locations, behind or one third up or right back. So it actually has implications for the way you work in time, mm, and the outcome that you have.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, so he's working with wall-sized inkjet prints, and sometimes he is making kind of brushing on the walls.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes he does both.
So this is what we can see tomorrow, some inkjet prints of digital art in a hybrid context.
But they're very immersive too, these large, yeah, scale prints. So when you actually come up to a wall, it becomes like that's where you get this interesting thing. You actually feel like you can fall into it, which is a similar effect when you're looking in a screen. You have almost this, you could slip into this other, almost narcissistic space, I guess.
Yeah. All right, a narcissistic space. Wow, for an artist, yeah? Is the wall a narcissistic mural or something? Is the wall something like a narcissistic space? Like,
well, I think when...
traditionally rotten, driving something.
Sure. Well, I think in a way, you know, you always hang a mirror on the wall, don't you?
Yeah, that's right.
And so I'm just thinking off the top of my head right now about this, but I think it's particularly with his works because you can, when you think of virtual space now, I always think of something like a pond because the computer screens are so beautiful. You could just, it's like looking at a reflection, you could just, you almost want to jump in there. And with his painting, with his digital prints on the wall, you get the same effect. So that same thing of wanting to lose yourself into another image.
Yeah.
And I think that it's not just about self-admiration, which is what narcissism is about, being overcome by your own beauty, but actually wanting to lose yourself into this other thing.
Yeah.
Is perhaps more what I mean. Mm. And that can happen when you're looking...
Maybe this is a good connection. Lost in art in lost Australia.
You get lost in the outback and lost in art. Exactly.
Yeah, and you should listen now to the interview with David.
Okay, great.
It's partly because I wasn't, I was a very slow learner and I felt more confident doing painting and I wasn't very good with English at school.
Yeah.
So it's a place I gravitated.
Were you in English?
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
But I wasn't a very, very confident child, so I just, it just became where I felt at home, making things.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's...
Yeah, and... okay, so when this idea came up and going to art school, how was the situation for you to be in an art school? Was there a kind of deliberating or negotiating about how to deal with the indigenous people in Australia in relation to what artists are doing now? Is to make corporations probably?
I think there was I went to art school and there was a whole new suddenly Aboriginal art was becoming been taken out of the museum into the contemporary art museum, so it became much more conscious. It was a growing consciousness of it being a major contemporary art force, and that's grown and expanded. So that was starting to happen when I was at undergrad, I think. What first happened with an artist that I really liked, who collected Aboriginal art in the Archive of New South Wales, Tony Tuckson, and he was one of the first to put it into contemporary art museum. So what, and to not be in the ethnographic collections.
Mm-hmm.
So it was. And the Papunya movement in the late 70s and early 80s. I went to art school. I started art school in 79. So when did I first become conscious of Aboriginal? I think we're taught about Aboriginal art, but it's different styles.
Yeah.
But even in secondary school.
Yeah.
But then when I became, there were shows at the university. Well, it's a technical institute where my art school was of Aboriginal art at that time, of contemporary Aboriginal art, which is. Yeah, so that was very interesting for me. And sometimes I thought that art had a more. Sometimes what non-Indigenous contemporary art was offering was seemed to me often quite empty.
Mm.
But that. And you could, I suppose, there was a romance about finding something else in Aboriginal art.
Mm-hmm.
but also that, I mean, that was the beginning of something that became much more complex relation later on, and you began to realize the complexity and the differences of traditional art, Aboriginal art, and the projections that that non-Indigenous audiences were putting on the art, so that you began to deconstruct those projections and have a more complex understanding of the complexity of it, I suppose. Because earlier on, the people superficially saw it related to abstraction. The way abstract painting was viewed in the Western, in modernist Western culture. So in some ways that was a one projection onto that art, that, the interest in that. But that, obviously it's much more complex than that. But also I play with various romances about different artists that seemed to, that I felt passionate about, that then I would deconstruct my own passion about those artists. So I'd actually, I had a very my main interest was in classical music, and I think I always had an historical interest in painting, and so that was a sort of romance in itself. So I would never, I wasn't necessarily always that aware of, I didn't work from the contemporary backwards, but I had revised interests in other artists. For instance, I'd go through, I went through a couple of years of being really interested in Kandinsky and absorbing all those things, and so that's when I was talking about the, my delusions at various times in my development of my career, I suppose. Just thinking of my lecturers, I think art school artists under I don't know how to say
it. And what would you say, on which point in your pain, in how you're painting now, are you now? At which point? What is the state of your art now for you?
State of my art?
In your kind of research about...
I suppose I'm thinking, while I'm here, I've been thinking a lot about the generational people dealing with painting and abstraction, and I think my position, playing with sort of simplistic notions about postmodernism from in the 90s. Now I'm thinking of my work being more more about it's a kind of like new complexity. I think that's a term that people used in music, but I see it's not, my work's not necessarily, might have ironic bits and pieces in it, but it's a bit of everything. It's a bit of in a flux, but it's not, it's not montage. It's not. It does try to fuse things in a sort of a coherence. From, so in some ways, I feel I probably feel less self-conscious in my work.
And how do you dream in Australia? In comparison, probably how you dream here, because you're now over a longer time in here.
How would I dream?
How, is there a typical dream for you here or in Australia?
Do you mean how I think about my future, my work?
No, dream, really dream. Because I, this is related to maybe because I heard... So, oh, come on, what's going on with the microphone? Okay, Simon.
Yes.
I got a question. Because you played some music from Frankfurt.
Yeah.
How did you find this music?
This is Low 500, and it's from an LP, actually a single called High Commissioner. And in fact, Vincent Spielmann is in the band, and we share a Wohnung with Vincent.
Yeah.
So we have good reason to play it, and I think it's great.
Yeah. And now we are listening to Cure. So
this is really dedicated to David.
Hey.
Well. Oh, it's just a great song. And it's just something we used to listen to a lot when we were younger in Melbourne. This music is really kind of typifies what happened in the early 90s, late 80s in Melbourne.
Yeah. And to come back to Australia, what is the meaning for you? Why is Europe for you closer than for us, Australia?
We were just discussing before this idea of Europe and how far away Australia is from Europe. But actually, Europe doesn't seem so far away from Australia as the inverse. And I think it's because all people are involved in what they're doing here in Europe. And Australia is just one other country from a million other countries that are in the world. But when you're Australian and you come from... I think Australia is inhabited by, apart from our indigenous people...
Yeah.
Settlers, and predominantly from, well, not predominantly now, but the main settlement from the 1900s up and through to post-war was Europeans, except there was a big migration of people from China in the 1850s. But then later, after the Vietnam War, we had a big influx of Vietnamese. So we have a large Asian community also in Australia.
Yeah.
So... But because, for example, it was very common we all went to Europe when we left high school, and, you know, you would always have at least two or three or four or five friends whose parents migrated from Europe post-war. And so children are brought up as first-generation Australians.
Yeah.
Particularly in cities like Melbourne and Sydney, in the big capital cities.
Mm.
You have a very cosmopolitan community.
Yeah, that's right. And you have always to consider that you are, or deliberate or negotiate, that you are in a continent, not in a country or a nation state like Europe is organized in nation states.
You know, that's right. And that's what is so conceptually strange when you come to Europe for an Australian. It's got more than one.
Their borders.
Their borders.
What is it?
Exactly. But it also had this idea for me, also because a lot of the Australian cities, except for Canberra and Sydney, well, the main city for me as a child was always Melbourne. That was the big smoke, and that's based on a grid.
On a what?
Based on the city is squares. The streets run north, south, east, west on a little angle sometimes, and sometimes you have radiating streets. But spatially, it's organized more like a grid, whereas in Europe you have Gothic cities and it's like a web.
Mm.
In Sydney, it's more hilly, so you have more of a web-type structure. But once you get into the suburbs, you have a very sort of ordered, systematic, rational approach to designing cities.
Mm. Yeah. And to come back to your work, how do you bring together object and sculpture at the same time?
Well, I think it's interesting that, I guess traditionally sculptures are objects. Is that what you mean?
Mm.
And so my work has always a slight performative element to it.
Mm.
Sometimes the performance component is larger than others. So maybe it's the sculpture that's performing, or maybe it's collapsing, or it's about to fall over, or it has a certain life.
Mm.
And other times I've literally had people go into the objects physically with their own bodies and actually complete the object themselves. So it's always this interaction or some element of performance within the object.
Yeah.
It's not a static thing.
And we can see a work tomorrow night where you reveal the vulnerable stomach. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And how do you do that? And why this point?
Okay. Well, This is work I actually made in Australia, but I've reconfigured for here, and I was interested to see what happens when you bring it to another place. So it's like a test for me. But these are, I call them on body suits. You put them on, and they're like a suit you strap on, and at the front there's a hole where you can separate your clothes and expose your stomach region. And I guess I was interested in the stomach region because that's the most vulnerable part of your body. It's where your emotions are set. Located, there's no skeleton around that area, so it's a very soft area.
Mm.
And it's interesting because even though, also in Australia, it's very fashionable for people to have their midriff exposed where your stomach area is, but when you frame it like this, it actually sets up a different way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And these suits allow people to connect up to one another also, so you can put one on and connect to another person.
Yeah. Okay, and then you have this work where people, I don't know, is that it's figurative sculptures where people can, in this video, sculpture themselves and make a picture.
Oh, the Sculpture Star video,
yeah,
is that what you
sculpture
mean?
Sculpture Star, yeah, yeah, that's right. Okay, sorry.
No, that's completely fine.
My feature.
That's just a very small video, which is, and often I make things quite spontaneously in the studio, and sometimes I have a camera while I'm doing it. But these are just simple pieces of cardboard, and to complete the sculpture, the person must take a photograph of themselves running. They have to go in behind the sculpture and put their arm out. So it's about the body being a part being severed from the other, becoming more exposed.
Yeah.
And the photograph gives it some sort of implication. It's also about how sculptures are portrayed. You know, they often photographs are taken, and how you present yourself is often through photographs. So it's this dialogue between the object and the person and the imaging of it. And the earnestness of trying to get it right, but failing.
But failing, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we are at the end of the show. So what I can say at the end is, tonight there is your performance, Help a Sculpture, in Galerie Wildwechsel, Rotlandstraße 98. Mm-hmm. Und morgen Frankfurt, Atelier Frankfurt, Ausstellung Guy Benfield, David Harley und Simon Slee. Und Morge. Und dann eine Woche. Die brauchen wir nicht mehr, die Platte. Das ist ein Feature.
Hey, hello.
You know?
Yeah.
Fine. And then 1 week later, there is a Rundgang in the Städel School where you show another work.
Stimmt. Exactly.
And because of that, David had dreamed that his fingers are handy. He play a last piece from this CD, Buried Country, Royal Telephone from Jimmy Little. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Felicia.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Ciao.
Telephone to glory, oh what joy divine. I can feel the current moving on the line. Made by God the Father for His very own. You may talk to Jesus on this royal telephone. Central's never busy, always on the line. You can hear from heaven almost any time. 'Tis a royal service built for one and all. When you get in trouble, give this royal line a call. Telephone to glory, oh what joy divine. I can feel the current moving on the line. Made by God the Father for His very own. You may talk to Jesus on this royal telephone. There will be no charges, telephone is free. It is built for service, just for you and me. There will be no waiting on this royal line. Telephone to glory always answers just in time. Telephone to glory, oh what joy divine. I can feel the current moving on the line. Made by God the Father for His very own.
talk to Jesus on this royal telephone. Jesus on this cross.